for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The conflict between Russia and Georgia appears to be easing, but the attacks have prompted a major reassessment of U.S.-Russia relations. A spokesman for Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf has denied reports of his imminent resignation, raising new questions about stability in the region. And Poland has agreed to allow the U.S. to build a missile defense system there. Joining me to talk about these and other top international news stories, Karen DeYoung. She's senior diplomatic correspondent for The Washington Post. Hisham Mellem, Washington bureau chief for Al Arabiya TV and Washington correspondent for An-Nahar. And Paul Starobin of the National Journal. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Good morning to all of you.
Good morning, Diane.
Paul, Condoleezza Rice is in Georgia today. What does she hope to achieve?
Well, I think she'd like to achieve a kind of formal signing of this peace agreement and ceasefire that was worked out by the French President Nicolas Sarkozy in an earlier visit to Moscow and Tbilisi. But there seem to be some loopholes about where the Russians are going to end up. Are they only going to be in South Ossetia, this breakaway province that Saakashvili, the Georgian president, tried to overrun, but the Russians basically booted his forces out of? What about the Russians elsewhere in Georgia? There are reports that they're operating pretty much as they would like. And the Russians have the facts on the ground in their support here. No matter what the Americans and Condoleezza Rice say, they are occupying apparently about a third of the country.
Karen DeYoung.
Well, this is the question, what this peace agreement is going to entail. I think what the West wants for now, the most urgent thing, is for a ceasefire, for people to stop shooting at each other, and for the Russians at a minimum to withdraw into these enclaves that are legally part of Georgia, but that the Russians claim and that these separate enclaves, in fact, say they want to be part of Russia. This, I think, is a fallback, a comeback for the West side, because the original negotiations and the original stand of the United States and the West was that the Russian withdrawal had to go all the way back to where they were before the situation started on August 6th. Now they seem to be willing to wait a while as long as the Russian troops go back into these two enclaves, South Ossetia and Abkhazia. So I think that they, at the same time, the Russians are saying, well, these places don't belong to Georgia anyway. And they're kind of daring the West to do anything about it. And the West appears willing to put that off for another day.
And George Bush said this morning he wants to see Russia stop bullying its neighbors.
Well, we've seen changes in the tone in the American administration. On Monday, the president spoke about brutal attack and invasion, and he sounded, you know, he reflected a great deal of bluster. Then the following day, it was besieging Moscow, kind of, you know, appealing to Moscow to think about its own international reputation and its stature. And, I mean, that's the posture of a weak party. The Russians did not invade in order to withdraw. Now, they invaded Georgian territory proper, maybe for negotiating purposes, to strengthen their hand. But I still think the objective of Russia is not only to absorb Abkhazia and in South Ossetia, but also to bring down the government in Tbilisi, Saakashvili. And they never liked him, and that's their chance now to reassert their influence in a traditional area that was part of the sphere of influence of Tsarist Russia and the Soviet Union. Putin, who is the real leader of Moscow today, realizes that the West is weak, that there are problems in the transatlantic relationship. The Germans are acting like a neutral state and not as a NATO power. Putin understands that the Americans have 170,000 men and women in Iraq and in Afghanistan. There is no military option. There is no sanctions through the United Nations. The Europeans, who depend on gas and oil from Russia, are essentially hostages. The whole world is watching. This is the end of the post-Soviet era. This is the beginning of a new era that the new president, American president, is going to inherit. This is going to be a messy world.
Paul.
And I think the Russians are sending a message to everyone, not just in the South Caucasus, but throughout these former lands of the Soviet Union, that they are back, right. That American commitments may be fine on paper, but the actuality is that America cannot deliver on these commitments. I think there's a certain frustration in Washington's rhetoric, which is proportional to Washington's inability to deliver on its rhetoric. I mean, there's a sense, I think, certainly among the Europeans, that Saakashvili has greatly overplayed his hand. I mean, what was he thinking? You know, I mean, there was every indication that the Russians would respond in force to any effort by Saakashvili to resolve South Ossetia by military means. He did rocket Svali, the capital of the city, and that's when the Russians came in. And so I do agree that this is now a new situation and underlied by American weakness. And I think the next administration, whoever it is going to have to rethink how America's posture is going to work in this part of the world.
Russia's foreign minister called U.S. support of Georgia a virtual project. What was his message to the U.S., Karen?
Well, you know that the Bush administration has been very, very supportive of Saakashvili, the president of Georgia. The so-called Rose Revolution has been one of its primary case studies to show how the democracy agenda, as the president calls it, is working. They have wanted to bring Georgia into NATO. This is something that infuriates the Russians. I think that this was the kind of disparaging remark that we've seen from the Russians all week, which is this kind of, you know, double dare you. You say, this is your country, you'll protect it. You're not going to protect it.
Because your troops are all tied up.
Well,
in
and because
Iraq.
The Americans, as Secretary Gates, the defense secretary here, said very clearly yesterday, we have no intention of becoming involved militarily.
And yet he said that Russia's actions in Georgia could adversely affect U.S.-Russian relations for years to come, Hisham.
Absolutely. That's why I said that there's a new reality in Russia. There's a new reality in the Caucasus now. Not only the former Soviet republics are watching with trepidation, you know, from Belarus and Ukraine to Kazakhstan, but also the people who live in the south of the Caucasus, Iran, Iraq, the Middle East. This is going to embolden countries like Iran in the Middle East. If the Russian invasion stands, this will embolden them because it will be another indication of America's weakness.
In reality, Paul, did the U.S. try to restrain Georgia from avoiding this level of conflict?
Well, you know, I'm not sure. It'd be fascinating to know. I was in Georgia 6 years ago when they were just beginning this training and equip program, and I watched the U.S. Green Berets, you know, training these raw Georgian recruits, you know, used to wearing, you know, flip-flops and tennis shoes. And the Green Berets said, you know, we're going to improve these troops, you know, exponentially, which was possible to imagine because they were starting at such a low base. And you kind of wondered where this was going. I mean, at the same time, I remember writing about the buildup of the Russians in the Southern Caucasus, you know, Armenia and other states where they traditionally have had allies. And you could kind of see in slow motion, you know, this kind of, you know, incipient clash. And the other thing, you know, that I think is neglected in this is that there is a kind of thread of Georgian nationalism in all of this. I mean, the Ossetians and the Abkhazians don't want to be part of the Georgian Republic. And, you know, that's something that, let's say, Woodrow Wilson could understand. But, you know, there's a little bit, you know, this is a complicated, you know, problem
Indeed.
Of memory and history and grievances in the Caucasus that go back for centuries.
Paul Starobin of National Journal Magazine, Hisham Elam of Al Arabiya TV, and Karen DeYoung of The Washington Post. Do join us, 800-433-8850. In the midst of all this, Karen, Poland has now agreed to cooperate with the U.S. on missile defense. How do you explain the timing here?
Oh, I think it's clear it's directly related to what's been happening in Georgia. The Poles, although the Polish government immediately preceding the one that's there now was very eager to make this deal with the United States to put these anti-missile defense battery in Poland. The current government has not been that eager. They weren't sure they could get it through their own parliament. They wanted something from the United States in exchange. They wanted a Patriot missile battery. And as recently as 10 days ago, the Polish prime minister said publicly, nothing's going to happen on this issue until after the U.S. election. Now, all of a sudden, yesterday, they make a deal. And on both sides, the Poles say, okay, you can put your anti-missile defense here. And the Americans say, okay, you can have your Patriots. And we're going to send 100 American troops there to take care of them. So I think that this is a reflection, as the Americans correctly pointed out, that the those countries around Russia's borders that are members of the former Soviet Union, now democracies, have been made quite nervous by what's going on in Georgia. They want to be enfolded in the NATO umbrella. And I think that this is something that additionally has made Russia very angry. The Russians have come out and said they view this as a direct affront from them, even though the Americans were very quick to say, oh, no, the anti-missile defense program is not against you. It's against Iran. The Poles have made very clear that the Patriot missiles that they want are very definitely against the Russians.
I think it's there's one interesting case where it's not clear that a former Soviet republic wants to be part of the NATO, and that's Ukraine, which could be a real conflict zone after this episode in Georgia as well. And it's a divided country with pro-Western and pro-Russian sentiments.
Paul Starban of National Journal, Karen DeYoung of The Washington Post, Hisham Malam, Al Arabiya TV. One point that we need to go back to in this Georgian conflict, and Paul, you were close to raising it, was the oil pipeline that runs through this whole area, yeah. Which is so crucial.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the great game with us, all these 19th century kind of neo-imperial overtones. I mean, in the 1990s, America backed this controversial pipeline project that would send oil from the Caspian, starting in Baku, through Georgia as a transit country, ending in the Turkish Mediterranean port of Ceyhan. The route was expressly constructed to avoid Russian territory. It was the route out of the Caspian that would not involve Russia. Russia has always opposed this project, made no bones about it. They have their own ideas about how energy routes should proceed. And so, you know, in the background here with Georgia, America has this interest in mind. It's a British petroleum pipeline, and it's, you know, and it's an important Western asset, and that is very much influencing, I think, these deeper calculations about how to proceed.
So if this conflict is not resolved easily and quickly, what could that mean, Karen?
Well, I think the Europeans are very nervous. They've seen before that the Russians are prepared to use oil flows as a means of pressure. They are afraid that they're going to do it again. They're very dependent on these pipelines, and this runs straight down the middle of Georgia. You know, we've talked a lot about the city of Gori, which is on the main road. There's one main east-west road through Georgia. The pipeline runs pretty much in the same place. And the Russians are now sitting right on top of it.
All right. We've got a caller in Ottawa, Illinois, who'd like to have a clarification. Good morning, Dave. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. One of your callers has said that the situation shows U.S. weakness. Does he mean military and politically, or is it just is it because of the current Bush administration, or is this just inherent in the U.S. politics in itself?
Well, it's all of the above. I mean, can the United States afford a third front, almost in the same neighborhood of Iraq and Afghanistan? I mean, you have 170,000 men and women tied up in Iraq and in Afghanistan. You have a transatlantic relationship that is not that strong because you can't challenge this, the Soviet Union. I almost said the Soviet Union. Russia now, without serious European support or support from the Middle East, you have a completely different energy situation today that did not exist 5-6 years ago or 8 years ago when Bush came to power. So you have a whole host of things. And then you have a resurgent Russia, resurgent sense of Russian nationalism. You have windfall of from oil and gas in Russia. And Putin is using that, and they are flexing their muscles, and they are willing to use oil, turn the spigot on and off on European powers, and the Europeans know it very well. The West is more vulnerable than at any time since the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Karen.
Yeah, and I think that even if there were a willingness on the part of the Bush administration to use some kind of military force in Georgia, which there, I think, is not, they've made that very clear, it's not like Iraq where they were willing to go in themselves, where they felt like they could do it themselves. There's no chance that the Americans would want to do this without the Europeans being along with them, without NATO being along with them. And I think there's no chance that at least the Western Europeans want to move anywhere near that direction.
I mean, the problem, people will ask, you know, I mean, is the fate of 70 or 75,000 people in South Ossetia deserve a conflict with this kind of proportion. I mean, and I think this is a serious question. I mean, people will argue for a long time whether what was the casus belli here, the provocation on the part of the Russians and the South Ossetians against Tbilisi, or the fact that the president of Georgia fell into a trap.
And that's precisely the question Charles in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, has. Go right ahead, sir.
Hey, Diane.
Hi there.
I'm just like Sal, I'm a very big fan of your show. It's the only place where I can get real debate on these issues.
Thank you.
The two comments I have is that, first of all, it's kind of hypocritical how the United States government or President Bush and administration is talking about going in and regime change and you should respect, you know, nation sovereignty when we don't on our own, Iraq and Kosovo being the main point. And as far as regime change, this government has been, well, this administration has been the main backers of regime change from Haiti to Iraq and possible, and one that didn't work, in Venezuela. But on to bigger news. Saakashvili, which was pretty much put in by the United States government, is, you know, pretty much a I'm not saying a puppet, but he's very reliant and dependent on USA. So I don't think he would make a unilateral decision to go ahead and provoke Russia without first checking in with Washington and its other allies.
What do you think, Paul?
No, I don't actually buy that. I met Misha, as they call him in Georgia, before the Rose Revolution, and he's a bit of a hothead, really. I remember that he had been appointed justice minister by Edward Shevardnadze, who was the American-backed president of Georgia, and he was telling me about how the country had been hijacked by Shevardnadze. He had left his cabinet. I mean, he struck me as more of an independent thinker, but very pro-American. I mean, you know, he had pictures of Ted Kennedy on his wall. I mean, he had studied in Washington. I think the more complicated picture is that he thought perhaps he could manipulate Washington into a situation where they might have to come to his aid. And he understood that Washington, or at least some people in Washington, really wanted Georgia as this kind of beacon of democracy, but also this, you know, this energy, pro-American energy transit corridor. And so, you know, there was a kind of clash there at the end. I don't think it's fair to say that he is simply a puppet of Washington. He seems to be a puppet beyond their control.
All right. I want to turn now to Iraq and a report from the Congressional Budget Office here in Washington on military contracts in Iraq. Paul, what did it find?
Well, the Congressional Budget Office found that there was some $85 billion that had been spent in these government-awarded contracts, which is a rather kind of remarkable number, $85 billion.
About 20% of the war's cost.
Yeah, and you know, a workforce employed by these contractors of about 180,000, which exceeds, I think, the total number of not only troops but all other kind of direct U.S. government people in Iraq. And so, you know, this seems to be, in that sense, a different kind of war where you have this kind of privatized function to the war. Of course, we don't have a draft. And so, essentially, we're on some new ground here. And
we're paying people to fight for us.
And how accountable are they, which is a question that Congress is raising, I think, properly, you know, about this workforce.
And certainly it's been controversial, Karen, in that some contractors have been investigated for shooting deaths of Iraqis, among other things.
Well, I think that we need to sort of stipulate that we're not paying people to fight for us, that the vast, vast majority of the contractors are involved in logistical and support missions. The ones who are shooting are a very, very small number relative to the total that are working in these personal security operations. They're either guarding buildings or they're guarding U.S. diplomats, and in some cases, senior military officers. But I think it's just to make the case that the military makes, and I'll make it for them without necessarily agreeing with it, but they say that, you know, when a decision was made to make the U.S. military much smaller, to have an army that is smaller than 500, 500, half a million or whatever people, it was decided that it was consciously decided that they would use contractors for a lot of these things, to carry food around, to carry fuel around, to carry supplies, and that while it looks like they're spending a whole lot of money on it, you have to calculate into that how much you would spend on benefits for military
service
people.
Personnel,
they don't
yeah.
get any benefits. Their
right.
contracts include everything. They just pay but the amount of the contract.
So the alternative is a much bigger military.
The main concern from the beginning was not to send too many troops to Iraq.
Right.
And they wanted the numbers to be low so that this will not create consternation here. But I think this creates opportunities for graft, corruption, vulnerability of the American forces in general, because they have to depend on these, private groups, whether those who are involved in security or in providing certain services. This is really a new terrain. It never happened before. This is the first major war the United States is involved in, where you have this kind of outsourcing to privatizing wars in the 21st century. It's very controversial and disturbing,
very,
to say the least.
Indeed. Let's turn now to the rather confusing news about President Musharraf and whether he is expected to resign or whether there are negotiations underway. A spokesman for the president has denied that he is about to resign. What do we know, Karen?
Well, we know that last week the coalition government in Pakistan finally agreed that they would send articles of impeachment to the parliament, that this is supposed to arrive at the parliament on Monday, and that there are behind-the-scenes talks going on between representatives of the government and representatives of Musharraf about the possibility of his resigning. He has not agreed to resign yet. The political parties certainly have lost no time trying to convince everybody that he's about to resign. But there are these negotiations going on, and I think that once the impeachment proceedings are started in the parliament, his options for striking a deal are much smaller. And he's very well aware of that. He doesn't want to leave Pakistan. He doesn't want to be indicted. He doesn't want to be held responsible for any charges anytime in the future. And those are the kinds of things that, his representatives are talking to the government about. He has, I think, up until quite recently, thought that he would have significant backing within the Pakistani army. He found out in the last week that he did not have that backing.
Paul.
And it's the army that I think is the real key institution here in Pakistan. And from Washington's perspective, I think the overarching interest is making sure, even if he goes, that that relationship between Washington and, the army continues. And Washington has been cultivating this, Musharraf's successor, his Army Chief of Staff, General Kayani. And so I think they have a good relationship with him. And so they really need a plan B if it turns out that Musharraf is gone, because, you know, those tribal areas, I mean, things are really heating up there, and Washington cannot afford to have this kind of vacuum, you know, this leadership crisis at this particular moment.
At 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. But the question becomes, if Musharraf does step aside, what happens to that whole region? What happens to relationships in other parts of the world?
I mean, the situation was deteriorating in Waziristan, even when, under at Musharraf's hand. I mean, as Musharraf's watch. I mean, this is going to go down in history as a very bad week, negative week for the United States, whether in Georgia or at key ally in Musharraf. President Bush invested a lot in Putin, invested a lot in Musharraf, and this week this is payback, and really it's just a colossus. Wrong investment in both of these men. And the United States will lose as a result of that. I think the era of Musharraf is over. I mean, you know, this may be a technical issue whether he's going to, when is he going to resign. I doubt very much that he will remain in Pakistan. The history of Pakistan tells you that former presidents or leaders or prime minister are either killed, hanged like Zulfiqar Ali Bhutto, die in airplane crashes as Diaul Haq, or live in exile as Nawaz Sharif and Benazir Bhutto before. He probably end up in Turkey, maybe in some suburbs of Washington, God knows where. But I think the era of Musharraf is over. This is a bad week for the Bush administration.
All right. And finally, before our break, Hisham, tell us what's happening in Syria and with Lebanon.
Well, this year, the new Lebanese president, Michel Suleiman, visited Damascus. This is the first time a Lebanese leader visited Damascus, a president, in the last 3 years since the Syrian forces were forced to withdraw from Lebanon following the assassination of former Prime Minister Rafiq Hariri. There was an agreement that the Syrians finally agreed to demarcate the Lebanese-Syrian border for the first time since the independence of the two countries from France back in the early 1940s. Also, they agreed to exchange ambassadors, open up embassies in their capitals. The problem is that the Lebanese and the Syrians did sign agreements in the past, the famous Taif agreement 18 years ago. The Syrians signed a series of agreements with Lebanon. Also, they did not deliver on them, they did not execute them, they did not honor them. So the proof will be in the execution of whether the Syrians are using this to improve their chances to open up to the West. They would like to receive President Sarkozy in Damascus. President Sarkozy gave the Syrian leader a kind of international respect when he invited him to stand next to him on Bastille Day, the day where supposedly the French rose up against tyranny. This is something that did not sit well with the American administration for understandable reasons. So, yes, this is an agreement that, if implemented, it will be first step towards real normalization of relationship between Lebanon and Syria. And hopefully someday the Syrians would respect the sovereignty of Lebanon as an equal state.
Interesting the extent to which we are seeing French President Sarkozy playing a role in these negotiations between Georgia and Russia, certainly Lebanon and Syria. Karen?
Well, it should be said that he is acting in some of these capacities as the current president of the European Union, which is a rotating presidency among the members of the EU. But I think it is fair to say that under the Bush administration right now, the Americans are not viewed either not as an honest broker or not as the primary voice of the West. And there are limitations on what the Americans can do. And also, let's face it, they're all well aware of the lame duck status of the Bush administration, and there's no point in relying very heavily on any agreement that they reach because they're going to be gone in 5 months.
So when Sarkozy first came into office, he suffered a dip, major dip in popularity, and now he seems to be on the way up again.
Well, he appears to be dueling with his wife, the model for coverage. You know, she was recently on the cover of Vanity Fair and these, you know, stunning photographs at the, you know, at least the palace and so forth. And Sarkozy seemed very much, you know, in the background. But yeah, I mean, I think clearly France would like to recover some of its diplomatic prestige, at least. I mean, France is always looking for an opportunity to show that it still, you know, kind of matters on the world stage. And so if Sarkozy can pull this off, then that will be a feather in his cap.
All right. We'll take just a short break. When we come back, we'll go back to the phones and to your email. Please stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Miriam Muscarolis and Grant Abramson, thanking the donors to the NPR Foundation and councils for their support of NPR programming. By the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. And by AMARC Foundation, supporting procon.org, with the 2008 presidential candidates' positions on many issues at procon.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with David Simon, creator of the HBO series The Wire. The fifth and final season is now out on DVD. Simon tells us about the newspaper reporting he did that inspired some of the storylines. Also, we remember the influential editor and critic Ted Solotaroff, who died last week. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
And welcome back. We'll go right to the phones, 800-433-8850. Let's go to Fort Wayne, Indiana. Good morning, Alex. You're on the air.
Yeah, good morning, Diane. All I wanted to say is that I think that President Saakashvili is a dead man walking pretty much because of the blood and dead in the caucus. And he knows that all he's trying to do is just drag U.S. into a full-blown conflict with Russia, which I understand why the Americans are playing into it. And yesterday, him being on CNN in front of the European flag, I think it was funny, presenting Georgia to be a democratic, free, advanced, democratic European nation. I mean, come on, this is not Switzerland. And also, I understand why the media in America is totally taking an anti-Russian approach. Many people now are putting books and profiting from talking about the Iraq situation and how nobody stood up to the administration. This administration had dragged us into a big conflict with Iraq, and they're trying to do the same thing with Russia.
What do you think, Paul?
Well, I think there's a fair point here about the media coverage. If there is a neglected thread to this story, and that thread is that Georgian nationalism was resurgent in the late 1980s and 90s. And they trashed, you know, Abkhazia and its cultural institutions, And the Abkhazians, you know, they haven't forgotten that. The Ossetians are very clear about not wanting to be part of Georgia. You know, they are a different people. They are sort of, you know, they're Orthodox Christian as the Georgians are, but they speak this language that's connected to Persia. And, you know, they have these long-standing ancient differences. I don't think the American media has completely focused on the sort of that thread and just how complicated and fragile this mosaic is in the Caucasus.
All right, and let's go to Daniel in Morrisville, North Carolina. Good morning. You're on the air.
And thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I kind of have two things to say based on what the caller earlier on has said. I was going to say the same thing. It looks like he took the word out of my mouth.
Okay.
I have lived in the former Soviet Union for 6 years. I went in when it was Soviet Union. I went out. I studied there, and I went out. I'm from Africa, and I went out when it collapsed. I mean, after it collapsed. And this is what typically happened. Most of the republics started discriminating, besides even discrimination, forcing the ethnic Russians. It's just like someone living in Florida or someone living in North Carolina, and all of a sudden the union collapses, and then they say, hey, if you are not a native of Carolina, you don't belong here anymore. Your job is gone. So these kinds of things, I believe, is happening in Georgia, in Abkhazia. When the Georgians went in there, they started a form of ethnic cleansing, which the media is not talking much about. And it's all about the overwhelming force of what the Russians have done. I don't condone with what the Russians have done. However, there are elements of nationalism with the Georgians, and they know it, and they are using this democracy. I don't even believe that the second election that was held, Saakashvili won overwhelmingly as it's being portrayed. He did something there, and he knows it, that he's not entirely as democratic as he's being perceived.
Karen.
I think that that's absolutely right. And I think the Bush administration has sort of put itself between a rock and a hard place here. They have used the situation in Georgia as I said before, part of these whole sort of democracy spreading around the world. And, you know, this is our legacy. At the same time, they will say privately, they're very much aware of the excesses of the Georgians, of what's been happening in these so-called breakaway territories. They have said again privately, much more so than they've said publicly, they were trying very hard to get Saakashvili not to respond to any Russian, what he saw as Russian provocation, to get them to back down in South Ossetia, where they admit, again, privately, that they were abusing the people there. And so I think that they're kind of stuck in their public position. Although the interesting thing is that if you look at, say, what John McCain is saying, he's been even farther in this direction than the Bush administration has, saying we're all Georgians now, basically taking upon himself the defense of this little democracy. And so the administration has tried to focus attention on what it calls Russia's disproportionate response, while making clear that it agrees that the Ossetians and the Abkhazians have legitimate grievances.
All right, to Ann Arbor, Michigan. Bill, you're on the air.
Well, earlier in the show, you were talking about former Soviet member states wanting to join NATO, and I was wondering, in the long run, is this going to be really hurtful to Russia if indeed most of these former states end up in NATO or armed to the teeth, and Russia finds itself even more isolated? Could you speak on that?
Sure.
Look, I had a problem with enlarging NATO eastward and into the heart of the Caucasus. I mean, to me, to tell me that part of the Caucasus is Europe and is very hard to imagine. I have a problem accepting Turkey in Europe, you know, or even Greece for that matter. Give me a break. But look, the Caucasus is a very complex area. It's a crazy quilt of nationalities and ethnic groups, and we are dealing now with the continuing reverberations of the breakup of the empire that we used to call the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. When empires fall, they you have so many parts to them. You have clashing nationalist narratives. In fact, part of the problems in the Middle East today go back to the breakup of the Ottoman Empire. So we're going to continue to have these problems in the Caucasus and the Balkans and other parts of former major powers, the Austro-Hungarian Empire. We all know that. This is not a black and white situation. Nobody is here is totally innocent. I think the Russians have legitimate concerns of telling the West not to encroach on their areas of spheres of influence. Now, I understand it will be difficult for the United States to accept a hostile regime in Cuba. I mean, we know that. That does not justify the brutality of the Soviet invasion. At the same time, Saakashvili also may have read or misread, or definitely he miscalculated the American position. And he felt that the United States, by pushing hard the European Union, NATO, to include Georgia, that he may have some sort of a cover. But I don't think the Bush administration knowingly and consciously led him to this. It's his own gambling and its own mistake. And Putin was just waiting there to pounce.
All right. To Edwardsville, Indiana. Hi there, Pat. You're on the air. Pat, are you there? All right. Let's go.
Yes, I am. Yeah,
oh, okay. Go right ahead, sir.
Yeah, I'm wondering that this conflict with Georgia has come about at a very, very convenient time for John McCain. He's a Georgia specialist. His main advisor is paid by the Georgian government. Is this a wag the dog? Has the U.S. government, the Republican government, arranged and encouraged Georgia to exacerbate tensions to help John McCain?
Paul.
Well, that sounds more like the movie version than the reality, but I do think that McCain has aggressively inserted himself into this picture. His foreign policy advisor, I believe, was, not still is, a paid lobbyist for Tbilisi. McCain has embraced a number of these former Soviet republics. I remember talking to him about Kazakhstan in a similar vein. Now, there, kind of interestingly, Cheney and Bush have embraced the dictatorial leader of Kazakhstan, who, by the way, sits on a lot of oil, whereas McCain has cultivated the Kazakh opposition, the sort of the dissidents who would like to do away with Nazarbayev. I think McCain is actually being ideologically consistent with his principles in embracing Georgia. At the same time, I think he is absent some sort of historical, sense of how complicated the situation in Georgia is. When he says, we are all Georgians, I can guarantee you the people in Ossetia and Abkhazia feel rather chilled by that kind of a statement.
All right, to Detroit, Michigan. Good morning, Gary. You're on the air. Gary, are you there?
I'm here, Diane.
Okay, sir. Go right ahead.
I was wondering, I have a question about the defense missile shield agreement with Poland. And what I was wondering, Russia claims that it's aimed against them, but my understanding is that it is only a missile interception kind of thing. So does that mean that Russia is planning to launch missiles at somebody?
Karen DeYoung.
It is part of the missile defense system that the Bush administration has been trying to set up. The Russians say that it's unnecessary, that it's not true, that it's only aimed against countries like Iran. And also, this brings at least 100 U.S. soldiers very close to the Russian border. The Russians have described it as a kind of stalking horse along their border, and I think that they said even today that they would expect in moments of tension to take it out if it were moved there. So this is part of the kind of really sharp escalation of rhetoric based on this week's events, but they have said for a long, long, long time that they didn't like it, that they didn't believe it was necessary, that they didn't believe it was not aimed toward them. And I think that they have to be well aware that the rapidity with which this agreement has been reached in the space of one day this week after literally years of negotiations between Poland and the United States has something to do with what's been going on.
Let's talk for a moment about what's happening in China. The Olympics have been front and center all week long. Have the Olympics helped China as a force in the world, as a power player in the world? What about some of the attacks that have taken place?
Well, I think it's very interesting and probably very irritating to the Chinese that that these attacks have taken place. You know, we had the a bombing the week before the Olympics started. We had the attack on American tourists who were the in-laws of one of the coaches of one of the American teams. We've had other attacks in the past couple of days. You've got a whole lot of international reporters there with an interest in doing things other than sitting and watching the Olympics. And they've all written about it. And I don't think we know yet, on balance, what the long-term advantages for China.
I mean, in a way, just as Georgia is not exclusively Georgians, because even if you take away South Ossetia and Abkhazia, I mean, there are another quilt of minorities within this tiny country we call Georgia. China is the same, and this points to the fact that there are many Chinese or many people in China, within the territory of China, in this case East Turkestan, who are not happy to be part of the Chinese empire, if you will. And in the last few years, well, since China incorporated that Muslim inhabited area close to the Pakistani and the other stands in the east, they have been planting more Chinese nationals in that part of the country. And in the last 50 years, they probably sent more than 6 or 7 million people to live there. This is what the Russians have done in Kazakhstan. This is a practice that these great powers always do, play demographic games. And I think now, you know, this is a chance for those people to put China in a kind of awkward position when the whole world is going to China, when the whole world forgot that China is involved in massive violations of human rights of its own people and the Tibetans and others, and everybody went to Beijing for a big party.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And to Davi, Florida, good morning, John. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, my question is about one of your panelists mentioned that Russia has been able to cut off the flow of gas to Western Europe. But at the same time, he didn't mention that one of the reasons that there was a dispute between the Ukraine and Russia about the price of gas. Ukraine wants to be part of the West, but at the same time, he wants to pay subsidized Soviet gas, which they've done for the past couple of decades. And I think also something should be mentioned. Germany and Russia have agreed for a pipeline that would bypass Eastern Europe and go directly from Russia through the Baltic to Germany. So that's my comment.
All right, Paul.
Yeah, I think you have to understand from Moscow's perspective, you know, energy and the power of the state are essentially fused. It's one element. Now, if you want to play nice with Moscow, then you get a good deal on energy. If you don't want to play nice, you're not going to get a good deal. You might not get energy at all. I think that's very clear. The Russians have played a very effective game at the same time of dividing Europe, in particular enlisting Germany on behalf of some of these energy products projects. And the Europeans as a whole have not, even though they are afraid of Russia's chokehold on energy, and particularly gas, are not really able to unite on a common strategy towards dealing with Russia as an energy power.
Going back to your earlier comments then, Hisham, it would seem that the next U.S. president has before him the task of avoiding another Cold War with Russia.
I don't think Russia today is like the former Soviet Union. I don't think Russia has that the power that the Soviet Union had before. But Russia now is going to assert its influence in its traditional sphere of influence, whether it was the Tsarist Russia, as is the case in the Caucasus, or the Soviet Union. And I think Putin today is acting as probably the strongest man on that Euro Asian mass.
And
there
with...
are weak leaders in Europe. There is a weaker leadership in seen, at least, or perceived by the world in the United States. The United States, as such, is weaker today. And in the new era that the president is going to inherit, there will have to be some sort of redistribution of international influence and power among rising powers, including the United States, obviously, China, India, an assertive Russia, and a weaker European Union. But the problem is that in the West, you have a dearth of strong leadership that doesn't exist in London, doesn't exist in Italy, doesn't exist in Germany. And that's why Putin is strutting like the way he is.
Hisham Malam, Washington bureau chief for Al Arabiya TV, Washington correspondent for An-Nahar, Paul Starb in the National Journal, Karen DeYoung, senior diplomatic correspondent for the Washington Post. With all this on your minds, have a great weekend. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg, with help from Susan Neighbors. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Emily Robichaud answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR, National Public Radio.